Let's get to Scalia. First of all, let me tell you a little bit about the workings of the Supreme Court. It's been quite muddied out there. You've heard dribs, drabs. You know, you just haven't heard enough of it that makes enough sense, that has enough fact all in one spot to really get it. So let me explain to you how this works. The Supreme Court, it begins each year, each of its kind of determining years, if you will, on the first Monday in October. And generally, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments for 7 months, from October to April. And they kind of schedule them in sequence, in breaks, in chunks. There's 2 week sessions, and the court hears like two arguments per day. That's two cases per day, Monday through Wednesday. And then if you kind of add holidays to the mix, basically the court hears like 9 to 10 arguments in each of those months, October through April. That's why it's so difficult to get a case in front of the court. They handle very, very, very few. And they usually handle cases, their specialty is handling cases where, let's say, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has said XYZ on the Joe Blow case, and the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals has said ABC on Joe's case. Two conflicting cases on a matter of constitutional importance. That's what you need to get certiorari, or cert, as it's called. And there are many cases presented to the Supreme Court every year that request cert that they simply say no. And when they say no, the lower court ruling, whatever the last court to rule is, that is the ruling that stands, and that becomes the law of the land. So, that's a little background on the court. Probably, and it's, number one, great to know. It's good civics. But more importantly, it ties into the rest of this discussion. Because of the court's schedule, and this is almost March, Judge Scalia heard a whole bunch of cases since last October. And the way the court does the cases is they have a preliminary vote. The court designates, or the justices volunteer. This is kind of a secret pact. Nobody really knows how it works. You know, there's one judge that writes the opinion of the majority. There's one judge that writes the dissenting opinion, that is, for the minority. There were a number of cases, and by the way, there's also a secondary vote taken. And that could change the outcome of a case. It can turn the majority opinion actually into the minority opinion. And it can turn the minority opinion into the majority opinion. And as two examples, Obamacare 1 and Obamacare 2. In those cases, the initial vote, John Roberts voted to upend Obamacare. And Anthony Scalia was writing the opinion for the majority. And as it was written, there was more discussion in the court. They re-voted, and lo and behold, Roberts changed his vote. I will always wonder why. Does the words NSA, tapping in, having something on you? Well, never mind. We're not going to go there. In any event, Roberts changed his vote, which really pissed off Scalia, by the way. And Scalia's opinion became the minority opinion. If a justice dies, if something happens to them during this time period, then every vote that they have taken on any case is nullified. Now, the court can just say, let's say it was a 5-4 decision. One of the justices, as like Anthony Scalia, dies or otherwise can't function. There's no chance for him to participate in the revoting, the testing votes that occur often with this court as the various opinions are written. And in that case, because of that, the court throws out the vote, which means a 5-4 case is a 4-4 case, a tie. And if there's a 4-4 vote, obviously there is no majority, and a case then automatically reverts to the next court down the line who rendered the last decision, the appeals courts. And the appeals court's ruling, even if the Supreme Court had been ready to rule, had to throw it out, 5-4, the tie vote, because one justice is missing, reverts it back to the last decision. Alternatively, the 8 justices at the Supreme Court can vote to hold it in abeyance, not issue their opinions, and wait for a 9th justice to be appointed so that they can again vote and have a majority, either for or against the particular item, either for leaving it as the appeals court decided or changing it at the Supreme Court level. So I hope you kind of follow that a little bit, because it's important. Okay. Here are 6 key cases on which the final opinion had not yet been rendered when Scalia died. By the way, I'm just using the term died right now, because I don't think that's what happened at all, and that's how I'm going there next, so to speak. But this is all very interesting and very useful foundation for you, because it puts the dots I've put together on that in perspective. It gives you, as they say, the motive. So there's this case called Evenwell versus Abbott. It was heard in November 2015. In other words, Scalia heard it. And it comes out of Texas. And it has to do with how districts are drawn for voting reasons. Critical, right? Critical. Because that determines how a state votes, and the state determines electoral votes for a presidential election. So, there's 2 ways to count people when you're drawing a district for representation in Congress. One is you count just the voting population in that district, or you count everyone, which includes, not making this up, children, felons, and illegal aliens. Kind of ties into immigration. You know, when somebody promises to fundamentally change a country, as Barry Sotero did prior to his election and thereafter, there's many ways to do that, and he's affected many of them. Healthcare, Dodd-Frank, I can go all the way down the list. But the biggest one is you change its values, you change its culture. And you don't do that just by attacking its faith and attacking its precepts called the Constitution, or attacking its foundation called the family. You change it by changing its demographics, by changing its makeup. That's immigration. You have open borders. You invite aliens in with different cultures and different languages and different thoughts and different values. Starting to make a little sense for you? This is a huge case. It could determine the composition of the House of Representatives. It could determine how districts go, and therefore a state goes, and therefore electoral votes go. Particularly in the South, in the Southwest, and in certain swing states now, like Colorado. If you count illegal aliens, you take 12 million, and I think it's more than that. If you take 12 million illegal aliens, folks, and you concentrate them in certain areas, you will completely blow up the districting which has occurred. And you will be giving weight to, even though they're not voting yet, even though they're not voting, you have given weight to their vote because you have given weight to their presence when you draw the district that determines the outcome of a vote. Okay, the next case up there is Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. This was to be heard in March 2016. It was coming right up. And this has to do with abortion. And Texas passed a law, this out of Texas also, that does require abortion places to be run under the same guidelines as any kind of surgical procedure place. Ambulatory, surgical centers, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And would require abortionists to obtain hospital admitting privileges. So this is another one, which, by the way, is also looking like, just like the redistricting is, looking like it's going to now be a 4-4 vote. By the way, that would make Texas's law kosher. Then the third case is Zubik versus Burwell. That was also, to be heard in March 2016. This is also known as the Little Sisters of the Poor case. I know you've heard about it, maybe just in passing. But this is kind of like the Hobby Lobby case, if that rings a bell. It has to do with Obamacare and has to do with whether the government can force mandates on somebody if it is diametrically opposed to their religious values. In other words, can the government override the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution? The Hobby Lobby case, which Hobby Lobby won, was decided 5-4. It's a good bet the Little Sisters case will be 4-4. There were six cases that consolidated into this one. They were evenly split from the appeals courts. Okay? In other words, the Little Sisters of the Poor has about, I don't know how many other cases, a bunch of other cases. Same question. Can government trump religious freedom because of a government mandate? And they were all combined into this one case. In other words, this case could blow out the Hobby Lobby decision and give further effect and force to Obamacare. Pretty key case. Never mind the morality, the right and wrong of the case. Okay, another case here. I had to do some research on this stuff. The United States versus Texas, also to be heard in March 2016, right? Next month, days from now. This is a huge one. This ties into the redistricting case. This is whether or not Obama's executive order granting amnesty to about 5 million illegal aliens is legal or it is not. That case has been stayed. A federal court in Texas said you can't do it and stayed the amnesty. The appeals court has agreed with the federal court in Texas. So you have all the lower courts saying that what Obama did was unconstitutional and will not stand. It is now up to the Supreme Court to determine if the President of the United States can circumvent Congress, circumvent the Constitution, circumvent existing laws in the books, and with a wave of his pen, legalize foreign aliens. Illegal aliens. Remember what I was telling you about how immigration is probably the single greatest way to transform a nation and transform a people? Now, who knows how that's going to come out? Obama has been slapped down several times, 8-1 and 9-0, even by the liberal justices, for overreaching his authority over the last several years. And to make this, to put this in perspective, there was a case, ironically, there are no coincidences, folks. Wait till we get to the last part of this show. There was a case, a huge case, where the EPA had its Clean Coal, its Clean Air Act. It was imposing ozone restrictions on coal plants. It was kind of the final death nail in the coffin of coal, which Obama promised. The EPA made this rule out of their butt. They didn't follow the congressional edicts. They didn't run it by Congress. They didn't means test it for its cost. They simply passed it. And under the rules, when they pass it, the coal plants are immediately supposed to start following it. It's the same old thing progressives do. Even though you know it's going to be thrown out, you put everything in a quandary and you drive people out of business until it can be decided years later by the court. And as a matter of fact, this rule has closed dozens and dozens and dozens of coal plant, which affects your pocketbook and your electricity, amongst other things. But this court voted 5-4, and fortunately the opinion did come out. It was the last opinion he issued right before his death, that the EPA's action, and therefore the administration's action, remember the agencies are a part of the executive branch of the government, the agencies work for and report to the president, was illegal and unconstitutional and got thrown out. It was huge. It was huge also because it foretold the high likelihood that the court was going to throw out virtually all of Obama's other executive orders, including the illegal immigration order I was just talking to you about in U.S. versus Texas. Which, by the way, it's not just U.S. versus Texas. There's like 20, I think there's at least 26, it might be 32 states that have joined Texas in this lawsuit against the federal government. I mean, this is a huge case that also affects billions, if not trillions of dollars. You remember that debt we went over at the beginning of the show? Well, you know, if we the people lose this case, well, just add a couple $100,000 to that million you owe, because that's what you'll be paying out for illegal aliens. Literally. Huge deal. Huge. And now Scalia is not here to hear it or write the opinion on it. There are no coincidences. Then there's Fisher versus University of Texas. This is an affirmative action case. This is, can an institution, a university, a business, whatever, number one, can they impose quotas on themselves? I'm going to hire 50 black people for every 5 white people. And I'm just taking black and white because it's the easiest, the most demonstrable. You know, there could be, I'm going to hire 20 Jews to every Christian. I'm going to hire 50 Muslims to every Hindu. It doesn't matter. Can you impose artificial guidelines by gender, sex, religion, color, race, in hiring or granting other benefits? And the converse, the flip side of that, is can the government impose that type of affirmative action mandate on an institution, whether it's a business or a university or a smaller, you know, a lower government, a state government, let's say. This is a huge case. Huge. As Donald Trump would say, huge. This is the second time this case has been to the court. It was there in 2013. The hearing vote was in 2015. Fortunately, on this case, I think, Elena Kagan, who's one of the liberal justices that Obama has appointed, has recused herself. And I'm not going to go into the weeds on why, but she did, and it was the right thing to do. So this particular one can't end in a 4-4 vote. It would have to be a 5-2 vote or a 4-3 vote. And this is likely to be decided probably, should we say, in the people's favor. I'm not going to get into the weeds on this case. I'm just telling you it's a very important affirmative action case and has to do with the right of the government to specify hiring, firing, and other policies, all of which bogged this economy down. And the last big case is Fredericks versus California Teachers Association. This is a huge case, folks. Huge case. Has to do with the unions. We know how powerful and how scummy the unions are. Not the concept of them. There's nothing wrong with the concept of unions. But we know how corrupt and out of proportion they have become. And so do most of their constituents, which is why their ranks has been plummeting precipitously, unless you happen to work for a state or federal government, in which case it's, you know, Gucci goo between the politicians and the federal and state employees unions. And all these people, including teachers, are having mandatory, you know, billions of dollars of dues taken out of their pocket every month. They have nothing to say about it. They can't protest. They have to be a member of the union. The money has to be taken out of their pocket, and the union can spend it any way they want. And the way they spend it, of course, is to keep those politicians in power who continue this theft of their members' dues. And that, by the way, is what right to work is about. The right to work is not an argument about whether or not you have to be in a union if you're in a union shop, or you don't have to be, or you don't have to be in a union if you're in a non-union shop. It has nothing to do with that, despite the nonsense that the left tries to throw at it. It has to do with, if you are in a union, can the union take dues from you and spend it any way they want, including to promote matters you don't believe in, matters contrary to your faith, matters contrary to your belief, or to support candidates for any level of office that you would not vote for if they were the last human being on earth. So, a huge case. By the way, the underlying court voted that it was completely legal for unions to steal money from their members, use it any way they want, with the members having no say in either the dues or the use of the dues. That was the last ruling on this case. A 4-4 tie, folks, upholds the unions. A 5-4 vote would have basically made right to work, which is now in 26 states, the law of the land. I personally think that if somebody's taking money from you, number one, you should have a say over that. Number two, you should certainly have a say in how the money that is taken from you is spent. That just seems kind of fair. You know, a word that progressives like to use a lot. It's fair. It's social justice. Okay. Anthony Scalia was the linchpin of the conservative faction of this court for 30 years. And you've heard about brilliant, and he is all the things you've heard about on TV or on radio. The guy really was a titan. An American through and through, and an originalist. An originalist means when you interpret the Constitution, you not only interpret it based on exactly what it says, but if there's any question, you interpret it based on what the meaning intended by the founders when they wrote it stands for. Which, by the way, has been the linchpin of the Second Amendment cases, all of which have gone to support of the Second Amendment at the Supreme Court. Because Anthony Scalia, being an originalist, interpreted the writing. You know, there's argument over the Second Amendment. I don't want to get too far off in the weeds here because I have something not more important, but something I want to focus on here, and that is whether or not he was murdered or his death was of natural causes, as they're telling us. Or should we say, as they have told us as the third reason from the first two, which were different. The Second Amendment says, you know, the right of a well-armed militia, blah, blah, blah. And of course, progressives like to argue that the militia is really the army, and that there is no individual right to bear arms. That is a progressive argument. Their interpretation of the document in this, you know, the living, breathing document. Progressives believe, because they hate the Constitution, it limits their power. But remember that the Constitution was written to limit the power of government. And any powers that were not given to the federal government automatically fell to the state government. And overriding everything was the power and rights of the individual, which is where the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, comes from. Unique in world history, I might add. There's been some that have kind of come close, particularly ancient Greece, but unique. Now, progressives say that only the militia is meant to mean the army. Nobody else can have a gun, and therefore all the guns are in the hands of the government, and the citizens, of course, are in much better shape because only the government knows what's best for you. I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek here, but that's the bottom line of the argument. The originalist interpretation is, listen, this was written by men who had just fought a revolution. And the revolution had been fought and won by individuals, farmers and blacksmiths and, you know, doctors and lawyers who had taken up their individual musket from over the fireplace hearth in their homes in New England and gone out to fight the British. And therefore, it was the founder's intention, when they wrote the original words, that every man, woman, and child had the right to bear arms in the United States, because only then could those arms be used as a defense against a tyrannical government. Obviously, the government's own army is not going to use its arms in defense of the citizens against the government. I mean, this is just common sense. And that has been the cornerstone to the Second Amendment succeeding and living and not getting stripped at the Supreme Court. And Scalia was its champion. This is a huge deal. All right. If we take the dots we've so far discussed, I'm going to get into the last part of the show, which is what really happened to Justice Scalia. I will tell you right now, I will go out on a limb, because I'm not PC, that the minute I heard about it, I thought he had been assassinated. And I'm not taking for a moment all the guff that's been handled about, oh, you know, he had chronic conditions this and chronic conditions that. You know, look, you could tell when a guy is healthy. You can tell by the color in his cheeks, by the bounce in his walk, by how quickly he speaks, by how his mind works, by how energetic and active he is. And that's not to say somebody can't keel over from a heart attack or a stroke or whatever. But don't give me this. In fact, it just makes me more suspicious when I start hearing, well, his doctor said he had some chronic conditions. It said, well, you know, 80-year-olds, certainly they're not in perfect. They're not perfect physical specimens. But if you look at the clips of these guys, and I mean, you know, like weeks ago in interviews, boy, he didn't look sick to me. You know, Jimmy Carter has cancer. He looks sick to me. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself because those are some of the dots I want to share with you so that you can make your own decision. But I believe that this man was assassinated. I don't think there are any coincidences. And when I give you all the dots that I've put together, and it might be the only place that they've been all put together in one place in the media, rather than helter-skelter, an article here, an article there, a point here, a point there, we'll see what determination you make. But do not underestimate the willingness or ability of progressives. I want you to think about this. You have a man who obviously is an ideological tyrant and an ideologue and a radical ideologue running this government. His name is Barack Obama. In the interests of his ideology and politics, he has allowed 400,000 men, women, and children to die in Syria. That's a fact, Jack. He has allowed genocide of a massive scale, more massive than any genocide, other than a few in Africa, which you can hardly hear about, since the Holocaust, back in World War II. The gas chambers and the ovens for the Jews and Poles and others, Russians. That's a fact, Jack. The Yazidis and the Christians, the Yazidi and Christian genocide in the Middle East is a fact. Millions of people affected, hurt, raped, captured, enslaved, killed, beheaded, burned. And he could have stopped it all. He could have prevented it all. This is the guy who left four Americans on a roof in Benghazi. Well, two had already died in the embassy. This is the same president who did not, along with his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, despite numerous written requests, provide extra security so Benghazi would not have happened at all. This is the guy who didn't send help to those Americans fighting on the roof in Benghazi for their lives and the lives of the other 30 people with the CIA annex, which included, by that time, the State Department people from the consulate. In fact, this is the guy who, either directly, indirectly through Valerie Jarrett, or indirectly through Pillory, or through the two of them, issued orders that help was not to be sent. Stand down. I've talked about this in other shows. I think these instances are the same as if Barry himself had pulled the trigger in every one of these deaths. I think it is that pure. It is that simple. It is that dark. It is that easy to understand. Somebody who can prevent a death, who takes no steps to prevent the death, is as much a cause of the death as a person who pulled the trigger. We know that he has lied to us time and time again about terror within our borders, which has led, that's a fact, this next is a logical surmise, which has led to more terror within our borders. We know that this is a man who has stripped the training manuals of the people who are supposed to protect us from murder within our borders, from valuable, critical information that these people need to protect us. This is a man, and therefore, a number of us have died in San Bernardino, Fort Hood, Chattanooga, and elsewhere. We know, although it can't be proved, that there are many rumors and many very well-founded and researched and footnoted books that cast grave questions on the people who have died around the Clintons over the years. Adversaries or people who can, shall we say, affect them adversely. We know that the woman who signed Barry's quote-unquote birth certificate in Hawaii mysteriously died, I think it was 2 years ago, in a small plane accident off the coast of Hawaii. Coincidence? Perhaps.